The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated August 5, 2024. The entire front cover of Time today is in bright red, including the outer edges, which usually are. There is a narrow white inner border, with Time superimposed in black, in large block capital lettering atop the bright red background. Kamala Harris is photographed striding across the cover in the bottom half from left to right. She's wearing black, a black pantsuit, a black top, black high-heeled shoes, perhaps pearl earrings. They appear to be white from here. She's smiling. She's definitely in a stride motif. Her hair is dark brown with some pale blonde or perhaps gray highlighting. She's following someone. We see only the back of that person, who is dressed in a dark colored suit. Beginning with the first article, The Risk Report by Ian Bremmer, a global movement against the status quo. With so many elections in big countries this year, it is a good time to look at how the politics of democracies is shifting. But this is no simple turn to the left or the right. In France, Marine Le Pen's far-right national rally scored big gains in the first round of this year's legislative elections. But it was an alliance of leftist parties that surged in the second round. In Britain, the center-left Labour Party won a landslide victory over the center-right Conservatives. In Germany, the U.S., and Canada, it is the right that registers major gains in current polling. If we look deeper than ideological labels and beyond voters in Europe and the U.S., an undeniable trend comes into focus. Voters are fed up with incumbents. In India, the party of still popular Prime Minister Narendra Modi expected an easy win with a record number of parliamentary seats earlier this year. Instead, Modi's Bharatiya Janata Party lost its parliamentary majority and must rely on partners in other parties to continue his reforms. In South Africa, the African National Congress lost its majority for the first time in the country's post-apartheid history, falling from 57.9% of the vote in 2019 to a stunning 40.2% this year. To form a government, the humbled ANC has been forced to turn to the Democratic Alliance, its main opposition. In short, the global democratic trend this year is a resounding rejection of the status quo. French elections were less a victory for the left or right than a noisy repudiation of the center, namely the increasingly unpopular President Emmanuel Macron. In the UK, voters handed victory to Labour, not because new PM Keir Starmer's party made a compelling case for a specific set of reforms, but because so many British voters rejected the Conservative Party after 14 years in power under five prime ministers. In the U.S., President Biden's campaign was in serious trouble well before his stumbling debate performance and the attempted assassination of Donald Trump. Canada's Liberal Party, led by third-term Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, trails the opposition Conservatives by 18 points. The approval rating for German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has spiraled from 73% in March 2022 to just 28% in June. Japan's Prime Minister Fumio Kishida scored a July approval rating of 15.5%. His Liberal Democratic Party will remain in power, but only after replacing Kishida. There are exceptions to the trend. Hand-picked survivors won elections this year in Taiwan and Mexico, but that may be because fear of China makes Taiwan the most special of special cases, and Mexico's presidents are limited by law to a single term. Claudia Sheinbaum does not represent landmark change, however, because she will be Mexico's first female and first Jewish president. The political cultures and dynamics in these countries vary widely. American voters worry Biden is too old to continue the job. Kishida is blamed for a party fundraising scandal. French voters tell pollsters Macron is arrogant and aloof. India is roiled by accusations that Modi has become too powerful. South Africa's ANC is riven by internal rivalries between President Cyril Ramaphosa and his predecessor, Jacob Zuma. But though every democracy is different, they share a common problem. The aftereffects of the pandemic have touched the lives and livelihoods of billions of people. Local economies continue to suffer as supply chains remain knotted, and inflation is stubbornly high. Government subsidies are drying up, and economic contractions, particularly in poor countries, feed migration, which fuels anger at governments in richer countries for failing to manage it. It is tough times for incumbents, no matter where they govern, and voters have still more anger to vent. There's a small photo here in color. A bright blue sky is in the background. The foreground is populated by lots of people, a crowd, a line of people. It appears to be mostly female, and the caption reads, "Voters wait to cast their ballots May 29 in Matatila, South Africa." There's a sign, a large sign, behind this line of potential voters, which says, "Electoral Commission, free and fair elections, voting station," with a big blue arrow pointing off to the right. Turning the page to the View inbox, Health Matters by Alice Park, senior health correspondent. It is summer, and flu and RSV have come and gone, but as ever, COVID-19 is different. Even though the pandemic is behind us, the virus is once again surging in the U.S. COVID-19 seems to be settling into a pattern of two peaks a year, one in the winter and one in the summer. Data from early July, the most recent available, showed rates of positive COVID-19 tests from labs, which represent only a small fraction of overall cases, continuing to increase. Hospitalizations for the disease also climbed in early summer, particularly among the elderly. Signs of the virus in wastewater, which provides among the most accurate real-time snapshots of COVID-19 prevalence, have been increasing since May. The good news is that while the number of cases is climbing, deaths from COVID-19 continue to drop. Experts point to a number of factors behind the uptick. First, people's immunity to the virus is waning. Only 22% of people in the U.S. received the most updated vaccine, which became available in the fall. Second, the newest variants are mutating to spread more easily between people, which means more people are likely to get infected. Lower immunity could also be contributing to people experiencing symptoms like fever, coughing, and fatigue more strongly than they may have in past bouts with the disease. Since vaccines give you better immunity than getting the disease, says Dr. Robert Murphy, professor of infectious disease at Northwestern University, Feinberg School of Medicine. The low uptake of the latest vaccine from last fall means fewer people have the strongest possible protection. But so far, the virus does not seem to be causing more severe disease overall. The latest data on COVID-19 show it is now starting to settle in and have similar kinds of statistics to influenza, meaning hundreds of thousands of hospitalizations and tens of thousands of deaths every year, says Dr. Paul Offit, director of the Vaccine Education Center at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and a member of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's Vaccine Expert Committee. And similar to flu, the people most severely affected are the elderly and those with weakened immune systems. Offit, that's O-F-F-I-T, says vaccines are critical for these people who are at high risk of developing complications from COVID-19, and staying up to date can protect them from being hospitalized. But it is important to set realistic expectations. The goal of the vaccine is to keep you out of the hospital, to keep you out of the intensive care unit, to keep you out of the morgue, he says, not to protect you against mild disease. The CDC's Expert Vaccine Committee recently recommended an updated COVID-19 vaccine for everyone, 6 months and up, for the coming fall and winter season. The shot will be revised to target the KP variant currently circulating, which should improve its ability to minimize symptoms. On top of getting vaccinated, it might be time for some people to consider masking again. Since a more transmissible virus is circulating and more people are traveling and gathering in crowded public settings like airports, if I were in a high-risk group and I'm in a large group of people I didn't know, like on an airplane, I think it is reasonable to wear a mask, says Murphy. That consideration should also apply to people who are sick. I think anyone who has a respiratory illness should stay at home, says Offit. And if you cannot stay at home, you should wear a mask. And if you're in a high-risk group, get tested. And if you have COVID-19, take an antiviral. The View essay, Immigration, The Border is Not the Problem, by Dinau Mengestu, M-E-N-G-E-S-T-U. Mengestu is an Ethiopian-American novelist. His latest book is Someone Like Us, When my father arrived in America from Ethiopia in 1978, he was resettled with the help of an immigration agency to Peoria, Illinois. He found a job working on the factory floor of a Caterpillar Inc. plant, and by the time my mother, sister, and I joined him 2 years later, he'd already found a two-bedroom apartment two blocks from the Catholic school my sister and I would attend. It was a startlingly American childhood, made more so by the fact we spent our weekends at a Southern Baptist church on the other side of town. My parents, raised in the Ethiopian Orthodox Church, had never heard of Southern Baptists before coming to America, but every Sunday there we were, in the front pews, the first and only black family to have ever attended the church. On a recent cross-country road trip, my wife and I decided to take our two children on a detour to Peoria. My family had left the city at the tail end of the 1980s recession, when unemployment hovered near 20%. I wanted to see if we could find Sharon, one of the members of the church my family had been especially close to. I had not spoken to Sharon in at least 10 years. We arrived unannounced at her doorstep just in time to take her to lunch. It was the first and most likely last time she would meet my family. On the drive to the restaurant, Sharon pointed out the Greek Orthodox Church near her home. "Your mom and dad tried to go there," she said, "but the priest or pastor told them not to come back. He said they would be more comfortable somewhere else." I was about to ask Sharon how they were able to do so at a Southern Baptist church, but she saw the question coming. "Your mom and dad met with Brother Gene, and he saw they were good people and told them they would be welcome in his church," she explained. "Before you all came, though, he went around and called every single person. He said if anyone gave your family a hard time, they would have hell to pay for it. And that was it. I don't think anyone bothered you at all." It felt like a confession when Sharon told the story, and I suppose to some degree it was. If no one at the church ever told us to our face that we did not belong, if no one ever explicitly asked us to leave, it was because the good people of the church had been compelled, even threatened, into accepting us. Had they not been, it is unlikely we would have ever lasted more than a week at the church. Given the current apocalyptic narrative surrounding immigration, it is hard to imagine the leader of a conservative Southern Baptist church making a similar kind of phone call today. Whether or not Brother Gene knew my parents to be good people, he knew they were refugees, and in the early 1980s, the political and cultural framework had yet to solidify into the often dehumanizing imagery that is common today. As a writer whose work is rooted in stories of asylum, I have sat in on numerous discussions in which immigration experts debated the best alternate stories to cast immigration in a more positive, humane light. Immigration as an economic necessity, immigration as a moral and ethical obligation, immigration as part of our cultural heritage. The idea that the story can be changed, however, sits on a precarious premise, one that reinforces the idea that the dominant narrative being told is actually about migration or the border, when in fact that has never been the case. A year before Brother Gene called the members of his congregation and told them to welcome us, another Southern Baptist, President Jimmy Carter, signed the Refugee Act of 1980. That transformative piece of legislation defined a refugee as any person unable or unwilling to return home because of persecution or well-founded fear of persecution, the same terms as the ones adopted by the UN in 1951. More important, the Act established an annual refugee admission limit free of race-based geographic quotas and created the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which helped families like mine establish new lives in places like Peoria, Illinois. That the Refugee Act of 1980 passed with overwhelming bipartisan support in an era of double-digit inflation and negative economic growth says something critical about how we frame and imagine the competing narratives surrounding immigration. Despite the economic challenges, the relatively open-armed embrace of immigrants that defined that act was part of a larger story the country needed to tell in the aftermath of the Vietnam War. In that story, the global refugee crisis that followed the end of the war became an opportunity for the U.S. to recast itself as a land of hope and opportunity, particularly for those fleeing the tyranny of political repression. The current narrative framework when it comes to immigration could not be more different. Today, the voices of authority on the other end of the line insist at every opportunity that the refugees at our border and in our community represent nothing less than an existential threat to the country. They are criminals, terrorists, and drug dealers, many from hostile or SH-T-hole countries, armed with fraudulent claims of persecution. It is a damning and obviously racist narrative, at odds with both the current and historical facts of migration. The number of migrant encounters, which includes apprehensions and expulsions, at the southern border in 1986 was roughly the same as in 2023 when adjusted for population growth in the U.S. While the total number of global refugees admitted into the country fell from a high of 207,116 in 1980 to just over 25,000 in 2022. The numbers on their own, however, mean little, even when paired with numerous other statistics that prove immigration is a net gain to the economy. And immigrants are 60% less likely to be incarcerated than people born in the country. The narrative persists, indifferent to facts, because it allows us to point to something other than ourselves. It is no coincidence today's border narrative mirrors some of our country's most intractable issues: addiction, and the incalculable toll it's taken on our country's most vulnerable communities, is a border crisis rather than the product of a broken health care system. Decades of political dysfunction and neglect have created a system of horribly underfunded agencies at both the state and federal levels. So our asylum process is overwhelmed because of the devious immigrants sneaking into the country, not because U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, which processes asylum applications for refugees currently in the U.S., is a fee-funded agency within Homeland Security, financially unable to process the more than 10 million pending asylum cases in its backlog. When the Office of Refugee Resettlement was created under the Department of Health and Human Services in 1980, more than 90% of its $416 million budget was allocated to help state agencies cover the medical and educational expenses of their refugee populations. That amount is more than triple what Congress allocated to the agency two decades later. making it that much easier for Americans to imagine that a wall would fix what we broke. While it may be hard to change the current narrative, it does not mean we should not imagine what those other stories might look like. They would have nothing to do with better or fewer or less economically vulnerable individuals and families attempting to enter the country. Those stories would instead consider what our borders might look like if we saw them as an integral part of our country rather than the end. And they would imagine what our immigration system might look like if we devoted the resources necessary to creating a just asylum process rather than the ineffective militarized frontier that currently exists. Tell those stories enough, and we might see that both the problem and the solution is us. Essay, Unity is Still Possible in America, Even Now, by Nancy Gibbs. Gibbs is a former editor-in-chief of Time and is director of the Shorenstein Center and the Edward R. Murrow Professor of the Practice of Press, Politics, and Public Policy at Harvard Kennedy School. A country born by breaking with a king inherits descent as a birthright. Generation after generation faces its test of conflict management. Crafting the Constitution itself, with all its convictions and compromises, balancing local versus federal power centers, a civil war exposing fissures in democracy's bedrock, and on and on. Battles over rights and responsibilities, suffrage, prohibition, isolation versus intervention. Then the serial upheavals over justice for multiple marginalized groups, black, female, gay, trans. Each era is tasked with not only choosing its fights, but also deciding how to fight them. Our current crisis of division, once again manifest as violence, feels shocking but not sudden. The dread's been deepening for years, a defining quality of this century that began with an election that ended in a tie. As our information streams fill with acid, it eats at grace and trust. Americans have always disagreed, exercised muscles of reason and passion to press for progress and a vision for the common good that we do not necessarily hold in common. Do we care about freedom or equality, privacy or security? Being a leader in the world or tucked in safely at home with oceans to buffer us? Figuring that out was the heart of the democratic challenge. But the information technologies allegedly designed to connect the world conspire to dismantle the values that process depends on. The tragedy, but maybe also the opportunity of this moment, is that relative to past brawls, Americans are largely united on key issues, even if you would never know it from the temperature of the debate. Red states, from Arkansas to Missouri to Florida, pass minimum wage referendums by fat majorities. Kansas votes to protect access to abortion. Two-thirds of Democrats agree the situation at the border is a problem. More than 60% of people think it's too easy to get a gun. About 80% worry about the solvency of Social Security and Medicare. And in one last flicker of unity, 4 out of 5 people told Georgetown University pollsters they fear democracy is under threat. This was echoed in an Ipsos poll of 2024 voters that found that while economy, immigration, crime, climate ranked high on the list of concerns? Political extremism or threats to democracy topped them. But this is where shared purpose runs into the shredder of profit and power. People disagree profoundly about the source of the threat to democracy, with voters on the left and right viewing each other as uniquely, historically dangerous, immoral, dishonest, closed-minded. In that dark vision, gaining and holding on to power and denying it to the opposition is more important than any single issue. And now comes the assassination attempt on Donald Trump, instantly cast by his most bare-knuckled allies as the culmination of the Democrats' campaign to stop him at all costs. Ignorance about the shooter or his motive did not deter reckless speculation. It inflamed it. Well, of course they tried to keep him off the ballot. They tried to put him in jail. Now you see this, campaign manager Chris LaCivita tweeted and then deleted. The central premise of the Biden campaign is that President Donald Trump is an authoritarian fascist who must be stopped at all costs, wrote Trump's vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance. That rhetoric led directly to President Trump's attempted assassination. Naturally, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene went further. The Democrat Party is flat-out evil, and yesterday they tried to murder President Trump. You can call this working the refs, trying to preemptively silence criticism, hypocrisy from the partisans who menace their rivals while mocking violence aimed at them. But because X is a reliably squalid place, some Democrats dived into the blue anon fever swamps as well. The last thing America needed was sympathy for the devil, but here we are, Colorado State Representative Stephen Woodrow tweeted, then deleted. Even as calls came in from across the spectrum for calm, prayers, perspective, peace, the furies channeled by the platform's amoral algorithms ensured poisonous rumors would find a million minds to infect. It was all hashtag staged. The Secret Service was complicit. It was a false flag operation, just the latest effort of shadowy forces to ensure Trump's reelection by any means necessary. According to the Pew Research Center, 8 in 10 Americans think people get different facts depending on where they get their news. This all but guarantees crises and conspiracies travel in packs. We watched the shooting, but did not know what we were seeing. So in the face of novel facts, we relied on familiar frames. People who already distrust the media or the deep state or law enforcement were primed to see in the drama of Butler, Pennsylvania, a confirmation of their deepest suspicions. The act of collective sense-making, as the University of Washington professor Kate Starbird explains, is how people interpret events in a shared social exercise, and a way that partisan players can twist an event to suit their agendas. The target himself seized the moment. "Fear not, I am Donald Trump, and I will make America great again," read the fundraising appeal. But here, too, is a possible path to safer, higher ground. Our discourse amplifies the most radical voices and alienates the rest. Actual news avoidance is at all-time highs, not just in the U.S., but also in other deeply polarized countries, as people want nothing to do with the vitriol they associate with political engagement. According to Pew, 70% of adult social media users say they rarely or never post about political or social issues. So we are left looking in a funhouse mirror as misunderstanding about actual beliefs drives us further apart. The nonprofit group Starts With Us found 9 in 10 Americans agree on core principles: a government accountable to the people, respect and compassion across difference, the rule of law applied fairly to all people. But only around 1 in 3 Democrats and Republicans thinks the other side cares about these values. Social media companies must be accountable for the harms they create, the addictions they feed, the lies they promote, as they dismantle their trust and safety teams just when they're needed most. This is not a call for censorship. No amount of content moderation can police the posts of a billion users in real time. But like other forms of media, they should be responsible for the content they intentionally choose to amplify and monetize. And we are each free agents of understanding. We can seek out reliable information sources, ones that try to get at the truth and hold themselves accountable if they fail. Or we can choose to soak in the comfort of confirmation. Even as overall trust in the media reaches all-time lows, people tend to trust their own news sources. So I urge my students to be intentional about their media diets. Omnivorous curiosity is a civic duty. Watch the networks you normally avoid. Read writers you disagree with. Seek out the perspectives you instinctively reject. The goal is not to change your mind. It is to widen the lens. Understanding is a two-way street, Eleanor Roosevelt observed. And when we do not see and hear the truth of our fellow citizens, we stand little chance of appreciating all that we actually hold in common, even now. Under the heading Nation, Tech Racket. Inside the nightmare health crisis of a Texas Bitcoin mining town, by Andrew R. Chow. There's a photograph on this first page. It's about two-thirds of the page. It's mostly green. No sky is apparent. Green trees, green fields, houses, lots of mobile homes, a couple of small lakes, a couple of highline utility towers, and then in the foreground, what looks like it might have been at one time a high concrete fence enclosed hog farm. It looks like little metal Quonsets in rows on kind of a gravelly surface. It's not. The depiction is of a Bitcoin mine sitting next to homes in Granbury, Texas. Andrew R. Chow writes this, and the photograph is by Jake Dawkins for Time. One evening in December 2023, 43-year-old Sarah Rosenkrantz collapsed in her home in Granbury, Texas, and was rushed to the emergency room. Her heart pounded 200 beats per minute. Her blood pressure spiked into hypertensive crisis. Her skull throbbed. It felt like my head was in a pressure vise being crushed, she says. That pain was worse than childbirth. Rosenkrantz's headache lasted 5 days. Doctors gave her several rounds of IV medication and painkiller shots, but nothing seemed to knock down the pain, she says. This was odd, especially because local doctors were similarly vexed when Indigo, Rosenkrantz's 5-year-old daughter, was taken to urgent care earlier that year, screaming that she felt a red beam behind her eardrums. It did not occur to Sarah these symptoms could be linked, But in January 2024, she walked into a town hall in Granbury and found a room full of people, worn thin from strange, debilitating illnesses. A mother said her 8-year-old daughter was losing her hearing, and fluids were leaking from her ears. Several women said they experienced fainting spells, including while driving on the highway. Others said they were racked by debilitating vertigo and nausea, waking up in the middle of the night mid-vomit. None of them knew what exactly was causing the symptoms, but they all shared a singular grievance. A dull, oral hum had crept into their lives, rattling their windows and rendering them unable to sleep. The hum, local law enforcement learned, was emanating from a Bitcoin mining facility that had recently moved into the area and was exceeding legal noise ordinances on a daily basis. Over the course of several months in 2024, Time spoke to more than 40 people in the Granbury area who reported a medical ailment they believe is connected to the arrival of the Bitcoin mine. Hypertension, heart palpitations, chest pain, vertigo, tinnitus, migraines, panic attacks. At least 10 people went to urgent care or the emergency room. The development of large-scale Bitcoin mines and data centers is quite new, and most of them are housed in extremely remote places. There have been no major medical studies on the impacts of living near one, but there is an increasing body of scientific studies linking prolonged exposure to noise pollution with cardiovascular damage. And one local doctor, ear, nose, and throat specialist Salim Balu, says he sees patients with symptoms potentially stemming from the Bitcoin mine's noise on an almost weekly basis. I'm sure it increases their cortisol and sugar levels, so you're getting headaches, vertigo, and it snowballs from there. Balu says, this thing is definitely causing a tremendous amount of stress. Everyone is just miserable about it. Not all data centers make noise, and industry insiders say they have a technical fix for the ones that do, which involves replacing their facilities' loud air fans, which prevent the computers from overheating, with much quieter liquid-based cooling solutions. But some of their touted methods, including immersion cooling in oil, are expensive and untested on a large scale. A representative for Marathon Digital Holdings, the company that has owned the mine since December 2023, did not answer questions about health impacts, but told Time it's working to remove the noisy fans from the site. By the end of 2024, we intend to have replaced the majority of air-cooled containers with immersion cooling, with no expansion required. Initial sound readings on immersion containers indicate favorable results in sound reduction and compliance with all relevant state noise ordinances. They wrote in an email, Marathon is one of the largest Bitcoin holders in the world. The number of commercial-scale Bitcoin mining operations in the U.S. has increased sharply over the past few years. There are now at least 137. And while similar medical complaints have been registered in other states, the Bitcoin mining industry is urgently trying to push bills through state legislatures, including in Indiana and Missouri, that would exempt Bitcoin mines from local zoning or noise ordinances. In May, Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt signed a Bitcoin rights bill to protect companies and prevent any future attempts to ban the industry. While some Granbury residents are fiercely protesting the mine, many others feel powerless to alter the will of a company with legal, political, and financial might. And the data center industry at large is only growing more dominant thanks to the twin forces of Bitcoin mining and AI, the latter of which spends a vast amount of energy training generative models to find patterns in data sets. According to a recent report, data centers will use 8% of total U.S. power by 2030, up from 3% in 2022. And if operators locate the centers near existing communities and prioritize profits at their expense, then the story of Granbury could become the story of other small towns across America. Granbury sits about an hour southwest of Fort Worth in Hood County, home to a mostly rural and Republican population of around 65,000. Approximately a 15-minute drive south of Granbury's historic town center, which includes a 19th-century opera house, lies the Bitcoin mining facility, consisting of over 140 squat metal boxes resembling shipping containers, housing over 30,000 computers. These computers started running in the summer of 2022 and seem to be switched on all day and night. The computers power a process called proof-of-work mining. Rather than relying on a central bank or governmental agency, Bitcoin is created, maintained, and guarded by watchdogs around the world, known as miners, who prevent tampering through a complex cryptographic process and are rewarded with Bitcoin for doing so. But the system also requires an immense and ever-increasing amount of electricity. While Bitcoin's first miners were solo operators, often working out of their bedrooms, the industry is now dominated by a handful of billion-dollar corporations that operate industrial-size server farms across the globe. In the month of March 2024 alone, the Bitcoin mining industry generated a record $2 billion in revenue. Much of the American Bitcoin mining industry can now be found in Texas, home to giant power plants, lax regulation, and crypto-friendly politicians. In October 2021, Governor Greg Abbott tweeted, "Texas would soon be the number one state for blockchain and cryptocurrency." The following month, the Commissioner's Court of Hood County approved the development of a cryptocurrency operation at a gas plant called Wolf Hollow 2. The owners promised local jobs and said they would mostly use stranded energy that would otherwise go unused. In order to cool the machines, the site's operators attached thousands of fans to the containers, which churned constantly, emitting a vicious buzz. As more machines were switched on, the noise sounded like a ceiling fan, then a leaf blower, then a jet engine. It consumed afternoon dog walks and revved through cloudless nights, vibrating the trailer homes of many of the low-income residents who live blocks from the facility. At first, residents responded to the intrusion by vacating their porches, retreating inside, and turning up their fans and air conditioners to the max. But many still felt tremors in their beds, including Larry Potts, a 77-year-old retired pastor who lives up the road from the plant. Potts says he stopped sleeping and started losing hearing in both ears. In February, his heart gave out after another sleepless night. He was rushed to the hospital and kept alive by an external pacemaker. There he was diagnosed with third-degree atrioventricular block, hypertension, and depression. I'm sick of this world and all this mess around here. He says he told his wife that day, referring to the Bitcoin mine's noise. We moved out here for the peace and quiet, but this has made me want to go. Some nearby residents say they have not been affected, but the number of strange medical emergencies in the area have piled up. In addition to POTS discharge papers, time-reviewed medical records provided by several Granbury residents. Hospital notes from 72-year-old Geraldine Lathers, 3-day stay, document new prescriptions for high blood pressure and vertigo. Jenna Hornbuckle, 38, lost hearing in her right ear and was diagnosed with heart failure. Ear exams document her hearing loss, along with that of her 8-year-old daughter, Victoria, who contracted ear infections that forced doctors to place a tube in her ear. And Avery Burns, a 19-year-old cancer patient, says she suffered from crippling migraines at home. But whenever she went to a Fort Worth hospital for chemotherapy, the migraines subsided. We are living in a nightmare, Sarah Rosenkrantz says, sitting in a barbecue restaurant in downtown Granbury on an evening in May. As rock music blares from the speakers and other patrons chatter away, Rosenkrantz pulls out her phone and clocks 72 decibels on a sound meter app, the same level she records in Indigo's bedroom in the dead of night. In early 2023, her daughter began waking up yelling and holding her ears. She soon refused to sleep in her own room. She then developed so many ear infections, Rosenkrantz pulled her from school in March and learned how to homeschool her for the rest of the semester. Over grilled salmon and hush puppies, Rosenkrantz shares her family has been sleeping peacefully at an inn downtown for the past 3 days in order to get away from the noise. But next morning, after returning home, she contracts yet another migraine that lands her in urgent care. Balu, the ENT doctor in Granbury, says he's seen an uptick since the new year in patients whose ailments, including ringing in their ears, vertigo, and headaches, could be related to the mine. These people here, they're good country folks, and Bitcoin to them is almost a foreign alien thing, he says. The noise is detrimental to their health and anxiety. Dr. Stephen Shaminsky, another Granbury ENT, agrees. Sonic damage is real. There is no disputing that, he says. Shaminsky says he believes the mine is causing mental and physical health issues. Imagine if I had a vuvuzela in your ear all the time, he says. The level of noise is appalling to Dr. Thomas Münzel, a German cardiologist who's a leader in the growing field of scientific researchers measuring the impact of urban and industrial noise on humans. In one study, he exposed young, healthy students to noise events up to 63 decibels and found their vascular function diminished after just a single night. In other studies, he's found nighttime noise pollution directly leads to heart failure and molecular changes in the brain, which may lead to impaired cognitive development of children and make some people more prone to developing dementia. The fact that the Granbury Bitcoin mine is emitting 70 or even 90 decibels on a nightly basis is like torture, he says. The most spectacular cardiovascular diseases will develop. They have to stop the machines. Studies have shown human-caused noise pollution harms animals and wildlife, causing oxidative stress and memory loss in rodents, acute anxiety in dogs, and a decrease in forest growth. Shanice Copenhaver's dog, Persephone, started going bald and developed debilitating anxiety shortly after the Bitcoin mine began operating 4 blocks away. Directly next door, Tom Weeks' dog, Jack Rabbit Slim, started shaking and hyperventilating uncontrollably for hours on end. A vet placed him on the seizure medication gabapentin, and Jerry and Patricia Campbell's centuries-old oak tree, which had served as the family's hub and protector for generations of backyard family reunions and even a wedding, died suddenly 3 months ago. It is nearly impossible to prove the Bitcoin mine directly caused the afflictions of these specific animals and plants. But as the strange anecdotes collect, they've added to the stress of a town that feels under siege from all directions. I have lived in Texas all my life. I've never seen an oak tree be beautiful one year and die the next, Jerry Campbell says on his lawn, beneath the tree's gnarled, blackened limbs. It is so strange. That article was abridged because we have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.